Dr. Ackerman finished chapter 11, so I think we're supposed to start in chapter 12. It is interesting, as Christians and the elect of God, sometimes we feel like we know a lot about what God is doing and why. And we find in this chapter, however, that God spares Peter but allows James to be killed. Understanding, and we might ask the question, why? And trying to understand some of these things, and sometimes we just will not probably understand exactly why God does some of the things he does until we have a chance to become children of God and can ask him. We probably don't know the real answers. And God rescued Peter from the prison at the last moment, but Herod was allowed to kill James. And God just does things sometimes we can't fully fathom at the time. Yet he doesn't allow the king to act like God for very long, because isn't that what we have, the way we might have done things ourselves? Can we really explain some of these things that God allows to happen? Probably not. God's will and his decisions are a little bit too far above us for us to understand, and sometimes to even guess at why he does some of the things he does. But none of us have ever tried to predict what God will do in any particular situation, have we? I'm being a little sarcastic here. I think all of us have tried to at some times predict what God is going to do in a particular situation. Unless God reveals his will to us, however, his will may not seem very, like the logical thing at the moment that we would look at, or the reason we would choose to do it. Yet he does all for the benefit of all in the long run. And when we receive the news of someone having, stage 4 deadly cancer or whatever, we wonder, will God heal them? Will God intervene? And when we seldom have an idea of what God's will is regarding every situation. Yet we sometimes, we look at situations. You can go back in the Bible, you can look at Job and Job's friends and think, we know the reasons why certain things happened or why God did certain things. In the book of Job, maybe we have a better idea because it's being related to us now after the fact. We begin to see maybe some of the reasons that God did some of the things he did. But next time you think you know what God is going to do, like Job's friends thought they knew, you can say, well, maybe I didn't really realize that quite so well. You can turn over to Isaiah. Chapter 55 is an interesting analysis, I think. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. What I wanted to read. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. It's interesting to look at that and say, I shouldn't try to predict what God is doing. I shouldn't try to necessarily figure it out right now. One day I'll understand. Most of the time we will be surprised by some of the things that God does. I think he thinks longer and harder and more accurately about the long run and what's happening in the future and how this is going to affect individuals and others together. And we just don't see things that far into the future. We don't understand things that far. And in some ways, I look at chapter 12 and realize this, why was James not spared, but Peter was? But in the long run in the book of Acts, I think we begin to see the reasons for that, or at least some of the reasons that God made that decision. In chapter 12, verse 1, Herod here probably thought of himself as someone whom God made king, could do whatever he pleased or do whatever he desired to do. That being king, whatever it was that he wanted to do, was God's will somehow. After all, God may be king, right? So I can do whatever I want. I think that's kind of the way that we're seeing Herod think, although I can't be inside his head and guess exactly what he's thinking, but or into his heart and know exactly what he was doing. But that's kind of the way I would portray his viewpoint, I think, at this point. So he probably decides that these Christians are getting out of hand and need to be brought under control, and that's maybe his approach. So in verse 2, he kills James with the sword. And these two brothers, James and John, of course, were the sons of Thunder, or Zebedee, most likely both priests, because their father was a priest, and their mother was Elizabeth, the sister of Mary, mother of Jesus. Their father was a Levite, and their mother was of Judah, and it's good to understand these relationships because it will explain other things that will happen in the scriptures later, like why Peter could not get into the temple area to hear what the Sanhedrin was doing in terms of their judgment of Christ just before his crucifixion. Peter was not a priest. He was not allowed into the temple ground. But we find that John lets him in to the temple area. Why was John inside? Because John was a priest. He was known by the high priest. I think it says that in another verse as well. But Peter wasn't a priest, so he couldn't get in. But understanding their parents a little bit, and understanding that their parents were, their father was a priest. It even lists him, I think, in one of the priestly listings somewhere, if I remember correctly. I haven't done that research in a long time, but it's interesting that that's the case. And then you find out why Peter was able to get in to hear some of the things that went on in terms of the trial of Jesus. In verse 3, so Herod, of course, feeling full of himself, decides that killing James pleases the Jews, and so he takes Peter into custody around the days of unleavened bread somewhere. Now notice, if Jesus' death on the cross did away with all of the things in the Old Testament, like the feast days, why is it significant for Luke to mention that this took place during the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Why wouldn't you use Easter or something else as your marker there to talk about, or some other date or some other event if you were looking for something historical to provide? Obviously because the Church of God was still keeping the holy days here. And then in verse 4, Herod probably thought, well, he'll keep Peter from making trouble during the feast days, so he arrests him probably just before, or maybe on the first day of unleavened bread or something. I'm not sure that it gives us an exact time that he was arrested, but it keeps him out of trouble during the feast days when there are so many people visiting Jerusalem and the crowds become large. So this would keep him out of Jerusalem, and it talks about, and one of the terms that they use for the feast days, all of the feast days were simply called Passover. Are you coming to Passover? Well, Passover referred to not only the day of Passover, the Passover itself, but it referred to the whole 7 days of unleavened bread. The Jews simply called the whole thing Passover, and that was a common expression. In verse 5, now here's another factor that we see in God's will. God could have allowed Peter's trial and death, but Peter had not yet written his two books of the New Testament. Maybe that's one of the big reasons in terms of what Peter was yet to do. Those things are all kind of adding up. You begin to see more and more reasons why it was not allowed. And we realize that sometimes people look at it and say, well, but wasn't James the author of the book of James? Wrong James. There's five different Jameses in the New Testament that are alluded to. And this James was not the one who wrote the book of James. The book of James was written by Christ's brother by the name of James. So we have, or at least that's our understanding of it. So it's interesting here. Peter had not yet written his two books, so he's another reason we see for him to be spared. And God hears our prayers. He is not insensitive to our desires, our needs, and the needs of the church. And he was offering, you know, there's constant prayer being offered for Peter. Again, it's hard for us to guess what God would have done without all the prayers offered. I don't know. I can't answer that question. We are left again with only being able to guess what God may have done or what he might have done. My guess would be he had other plans for Peter, so he took him out of Herod's hands, but there's no way I can know all of the reasons, certainly, that God would do something like that, or why he did what he did. That'll be part of our learning to become like him one day and make the same kinds of decisions that he does. In the future, we can learn about how to see into the future and determine what is best for all concerned and what fulfills God's will best. And I think we'll have, you know, oftentimes I've expressed it, well, how will we know what God wants us to do when we're children of God in each and every situation? I think we'll have something like what we call telepathy today, an instantaneous communication with God that we can use to fulfill his will and do what, you know, he's looking for us to do. If we have questions, we get instantaneous answers. And I think that's kind of the relationship, I hope, that we have with God at that point in time and how he directs us. In verse 6, notice when Herod was about to bring Peter out. So almost at the last moment, God begins to intervene. And this is probably near the end of the days of unleavened bread at this point. Peter was heavily guarded too. At this time, prisoner guards and jailers, of course, were totally responsible for what happened in the prison. If a prisoner escaped, it was automatic. Whoever was the guard or the guards over that individual and maybe even the jailer, all were put to death. I mean, that was simply the process under Roman law of how things were handled. So if somebody escaped, you could count on you losing your life as a result. So you can imagine they were very carefully guarded prisoners when they were a guard. The Roman Empire was not a very forgiving place when it came to things like this. In verse 7, we find God's will is being carried out by the angel, and the chains fall off of Peter as he stands up, having probably been somewhat sound asleep at this point. And in verse 8, so Peter follows the angel's instructions, ties on his sandals. The outer garment here that is being talked about, himation is the Greek word for it. It means a cloak or a wrap that you would put over yourself in a little bit chillier weather. And Peter probably took that off to put on the floor to wrap himself up in while he was sleeping. So he didn't have it on, but he may have had undergarments on underneath. So he's putting on this cloak as well. And being awakened out of a sound sleep, you know, and being kicked in the ribs to be awakened, I imagine it wasn't a very hard kick, but, you know, enough to wake you out of your stupor, so to speak, real quickly. And he gets up and he puts on the cloak. And, of course, he's been asleep. This is a miracle in the middle of the night. Peter's probably not expecting this. In verse 10, so the angel walks Peter out of the prison through the multiple gates. And the iron gate, of course, that opens of its own accord. In reality, the angel is probably the one who's opening the gate, but it seems like to Peter that it's opening of its own accord. And Satan undoubtedly, you know, has been thwarted, so to speak, here. I'm sure he would like to have seen Peter put to death. And the angel walks him right down to the city. And down the street to the city, or so to speak. And by this time, Peter is awake, and he realizes this isn't a dream. You know, maybe up to this point, as he's trying to figure out what's happening, he realizes this isn't a dream. He's actually outside the prison. So in verse 11, now let's take a look at the lesson behind all of this. Why is this happening? Who probably stirred up Herod to do this? Well, Satan, undoubtedly. This was one of his targets. If he could knock out Peter this early, it would really certainly disrupt God's plans. And Satan undoubtedly received permission to take James and to kill him, just as ancient Israel was persecuted under Pharaoh for a very long time. It is now almost the end of the days of unleavened bread, and Herod felt he was going to bring Peter out, so maybe this miracle of the angel letting Peter out may have taken place on the seventh day of unleavened bread or very near the end of the days of unleavened bread. The Bible doesn't say for sure what happened to ancient Israel on the last day of unleavened bread. What do we traditionally point to? Well, they went through the Red Sea, right? And they were rescued from whom? Pharaoh. Symbolic of Satan, right? It wouldn't surprise me to find out that this took place on the seventh day of unleavened bread. But, you know, it's just my speculation. But it seems to fit with the custom and our ideas of the meaning of the seventh day of unleavened bread. Tradition, of course, had it. They crossed the Red Sea, and you know, Egypt was drowned in the sea, or the Egyptian army was drowned in the sea. And I'm looking at the scripture, thinking, is there a parallel here with what's happening to Peter? Well, maybe. Maybe there's a good possibility. Peter was in prison, but someone must have, you know, given the seventh day of unleavened bread sermon that day or the day before. Or was about to give it on that day, and perhaps they intended to refer to the waters destroying the army of Pharaoh. And in this case, Satan often thinks he has the victory by killing James, but in reality he doesn't. They needed to pray for God's protection, of course, for Peter. I'm sure Satan knew that James was an important part of what God was doing in the church. But God would have known in James's case that James was ready for his kingdom at this point. So he allowed Satan to have his way in this particular instance, because his brother John, also a priest, would later fulfill what God had in mind in terms of the New Testament scriptures, in terms of the finishing of the early New Testament church work. The editing, the canonization of the New Testament, a number of things that probably would have fallen to John to do. So there's a lot of reasons why God, I'm sure, made all of those decisions. I'm only speculating about a few, but there may have been many reasons. In the last part of verse 11, Peter relates the miracle as God's hands protecting him from both Herod and the Jewish people. And then the Jews, of course, are persecuting the church this time, not the Egyptians. But the same parallel here begins to apply. Peter, while in prison, had probably been thinking of, of Herod taking James's life. He'll do the same to me within a short period of time. So Peter was probably a little depressed, a little feeling a little bad, but at the same time realizing, well, you know, maybe this is it for me too. Maybe my time has come to an end. And surprisingly, then he gets kicked in the ribs and wakes up and finds out, well, it's not my time. So in verse 12, Peter is reviewing all of this in his mind, and he arrives at Mary's house. Now, all this has been going through his head. And this is not the mother of Jesus, but the mother of John, who we know as Mark, or John Mark, the young man who wrote the Gospel of Mark. And we don't know who John Mark's father was. He is not mentioned. But we find throughout the story later that John Mark became a disciple of Peter. And Peter undoubtedly had a great deal of influence on him and his writing of the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark. In fact, it's under the auspices of Peter that Mark's gospel became canonized as the second book in the four books of the gospel. John Mark was an educated young man, very good at editing. He also helped Paul edit many of his materials. Many gathered are here gathered at his house, and they're praying for Peter. And in verse 13, Peter knocks, and the girl named Rhoda comes to the door. And she, in verse 14, recognizes Peter. As she's so excited, she doesn't even open the gate, but runs back inside to announce that Peter is outside of the gate. And Peter's probably laughing about this already, and thinking, well, the least you could have done was open the gate. But anyway, he's laughing about this. Maybe I'm pushing the analogy a little bit far, but I'm sure Peter found it humorous, maybe, by what she did. How foolish was it for ancient Israel to travel all the way into the promised land, then get scared and not trust God to take them into the promised land at the last moment? Is there a little parallel here with the story? When we look at these stories and put them together, perhaps in a humorous way, God is continuing the analogy in Peter's mind. But I realize that's reading a little bit in between the lines, but it is possible with this analogy going on in Peter's mind, he's being given material for his maybe seventh day of unleavened bread sermon later that day, or, I don't know, or maybe coming up for Pentecost in his sermon there, or for the following Sabbath, I don't know. For the days of unleavened bread sermon, exactly what the date is that he gets out and when he's out of the prison, I don't know. But verse 15, of course, everyone inside had not seen Peter, and they thought Rhoda was crazy. They knew how secure Roman prisons were and how carefully prisoners were being watched. And this statement, I think, that people thought it was Peter's angel isn't very easy to explain. I personally think that among some of the Jews at this time, it was felt that each person, each of God's people, had an angel watching out for them. Many people are of that same opinion today. And that may be true, or it may not be true. The scriptures don't tell us specifically that that's the case. And some believe the angel, when in human form, took on the appearance of the person to whom they were protecting. And so maybe that's why they thought that this person at the gate, or this individual at the gate, was Peter's angel, not Peter. Now, I'm only putting that in there because some commentaries propose that as a possibility, and I propose it as a possibility, but it's not, there's nothing to document that that's the case. But that may have been something commonly believed by the Jews of the day. Perhaps it's where people get that same idea about having a guardian angel today. I don't know. But perhaps they knew this belief, as he writes here, and maybe Luke is kind of relating it because that's what people kind of understood at the time. So why doesn't someone go to the front gate and see who's there? and we're kind of left hanging here by Luke for a moment. And then in verse 16, by this time, Peter continues to knock, wondering, is anybody going to come to the gate? Hoping someone will answer. Of course, they were shocked to see Peter when they actually went out to the gate and opened it to let him in. And in verse 17, at first there was a shock at seeing him, I'm sure, and a great expression of relief and happiness and thankfulness that God has, brought him out alive and well out of the prison. And maybe things got pretty noisy, so Peter has to motion for a little quiet here so he can explain to everybody at once what has happened and how it has happened, and God, via the angel, has rescued him out of the prison. So Peter then tells him to take the story and tell James and the brethren. This is the other James who is still alive. Why does he say to tell James? And what is it that he's going to tell James? Or why does he say to tell James? Why not the rest of the apostles? Why not others? I think what we're seeing here is there is already there are certain responsibilities and assignments among the apostles in terms of what they're doing. James becomes the pastor of the Jerusalem church later. As pastor of the Jerusalem church, they're in Jerusalem, who would you want to inform first about what was going on in his church area? James. And I think that's why Peter says to inform James. There could be as many as five different Jameses, as I said before. We don't always know which James is being referred to. Three of the five are very prominent. First, there's James the Great, who is the brother of John, the one who has been killed, the Sons of Thunder, has been killed by Herod with the sword, and is one of the 12 apostles, and he was killed by Herod in chapter 12, we see. And the second James mentioned is the disciple James, the son of Alphaeus, and he's mentioned four times in the New Testament. We don't know much about him other than that and those four mentionings of him. And the third one is James, the brother of Christ. Historians and theologians believe he is the one who became the head of the Jerusalem church and who wrote the book of James in the New Testament. And I believe this James is the one that Peter refers to in Acts chapter 12, verse 17. And is the one who became the pastor of the Jerusalem congregation, and as such leads the Acts 15 conference, or is the host, shall we say, of the Acts 15 conference that we'll see in a few chapters here, because he was the pastor there, therefore he hosted the conference that took place in Jerusalem. Peter is going to some other location here in verse 17, maybe to be in hiding for a little while, because he figures Herod's going to be pretty angry about the fact that his prime prisoner has escaped until Herod cools off a little bit. So Peter goes into hiding. The Bible doesn't even tell us where Peter's going. It's just, you know, he goes away. In verse 18, so dawn comes, and as dawn comes, Luke makes an understatement by saying, there was no small stir among the soldiers as to Peter's whereabouts. Well, you can bet there is. Their lives all depended on it. Of course, our lives were on the line. And in verse 19, Herod has no, how do I say it? Herod is no stranger to cruelty, I guess is maybe the best way to say it. He is maybe not a Roman himself, but he's certainly through and through as cruel as they could be. And when it says he examined the guards, there was probably torture involved in that process. Then summarily he had them put to death, just as the customary Roman process of dealing with guards who failed to guard prisoners. Today prisoners, prisoner guards are, you know, make reasonably good money, and they run few risks in comparison to what they probably did during Roman times. Verse 20, Herod the king here is Herod Antipas, and Herod the Great had two sons after his death, and his kingdoms were divided among his children. Herod Antipas is one of his sons, and Archelaus is another. Herod Archelaus was given Judea. However, Archelaus murdered 3,000 prominent citizens in Judea and was never confirmed as king. And Augustus Caesar took away his authority over Judea shortly after that incident of slaying 3,000 people in Judea, and kind of took it under direct Roman rule. Instead of having a king over Judea, Augustus Caesar took control of it back directly to Rome, and instead of having a king, they put a governor over it, and the governor was responsible directly to Caesar. So Herod the Great is made king of Judea by the Romans in 40 BC is when he started his reign. Herod Antipas, his son, inherited Galilee and Perea from his father in 4 BC. Herod Antipas was on the throne when Jesus began his ministry. And then he killed John the Baptist because he ruled Galilee, and he was one of the individuals allowed to intervene or to interview Jesus Christ before his crucifixion by Pontius Pilate, who was the governor directly responsible to Rome. Pilate, when he learned that Jesus was from Galilee, hoped that Herod Antipas would take responsibility for Jesus off of his hands and perhaps take the case away to be tried in Galilee. But Herod had no interest in doing so, so he only hoped that Jesus would perform some miracle. That's why he wanted to talk to Jesus, and he thought he'd get to see Jesus perform some miracle. And when Jesus didn't perform a miracle for him, he sent him back to Pilate. I've got no further interest in this case. So why was Herod displeased with those of Tyre and Sidon is a question we might ask. Well, Tyre and Sidon were both coastal port cities. Both were not under Herod's jurisdiction, but rather under Rome's protection. And another way this verse 20 could be interpreted is that he was contemplating hostilities with Tyre and Sidon. Both Phoenician cities, which he was probably in competition with as far as their goods, their sales, and their marketing or whatever. But a great deal of their trade was sent to and sold in Galilee, so they were dependent upon his kingdom for much of their profits. And through the king's council, Blastus, they probably came to the king seeking peace and some mutually beneficial agreement of some kind in terms of trade. Herod's home port city was Caesarea, also in competition with Tyre and Sidon. And it's likely that Tyre and Sidon, being cities with very small landmass, depended upon Galilee for food in exchange for their purchase of various luxuries that the Tyrrhenians and Sidonians obtained in their seafaring trade, both Phoenician cities. Phoenicians were great sailors. They sailed the Mediterranean Sea and took goods from one end of the sea to the other. However, the exact nature of Herod's anger with them is not fully known. So historically, we just have to kind of speculate, you know, why was he so angry with Tyre and Sidon? In verse 21, so Herod is now going to make a big oration to the representatives of Tyre and Sidon. He's both trying to impress and kind of bring them over to his side and make them a little more easy to negotiate with in terms of making himself and his Caesarean brethren happy. A lot of reasoning as to why he wanted to have this opportunity to talk to them. And in verse 22, again, because the Tyrrhenians and the Sidonians were looking for Herod's favor, they will listen very intently to what he has to say, and they'll try to impress Herod by fawning their respect for him and his speech. And so some in the crowd yelled that it was the voice of a god speaking to them, not the voice of a man. They were trying to impress Herod with how much they liked him, and appeal to his vanity, that sort of thing. And of course, Herod was very open to having his vanity appealed to, and so he was impressed with them, and you know, he was really puffed up at, you know, what they said about him. So in verse 23, it's interesting here, but God was not quite so impressed with Herod and the things he was doing, and so we see the angel struck him with worms, and he eventually died from it in exile. Herod Antipas eventually fell out of favor with Caesar and was sent into exile, where he died consumed by the worms, as the Bible indicates here. Perhaps we should consider how we take a compliment from someone else. Is there a little lesson in here? Maybe our vanity shouldn't be quite so high about taking compliments from other people, that we don't attribute them to God. so to speak. If it's true complement, then whatever attribute that we've received is probably something that God helped us develop. So who's the complement really to? Well, it's to God, not to us. If the compliment's phony or undeserved, then we need to refuse it, ignore it, not let it build up our ego. And Herod was apparently unable to do that. Verse 24, Luke drops the subject here now, and he expresses that the word of God grew and multiplied. So he's kind of summarizing what these events led to, that the word of God grew and multiplied. There was great growth beginning to occur for the church. And in verse 25, we enter into a new subject. Perhaps chapter 13 should really start with verse 25 of chapter 12. You know, if we had the chapters divided in the right places, I would suspect that's probably the case. But what we're seeing here is the introduction of Barnabas and Saul returning from Jerusalem after fulfilling their ministry or their service, and took with them John, whose surname was Mark. So we're talking about John Mark here, the same young man who may have been as young as, I don't know, 16, 17 years old here at this point in time as the Gospels are occurring, and maybe a little bit older now that he's going to be traveling with Barnabas and Saul. And as we call him John Mark, the author, of course, of the second Gospel. We'll see why some of this is significant a little bit later. When did we start? I didn't even look at the time. 3:30-ish? Okay, so I've got roughly 25 minutes or so to go. First, let's take a look at Barnabas here. Barnabas and Saul, rather than the later Paul and Barnabas that we see, because Barnabas is the lead evangelist or the lead elder here in this particular case. Later we're going to see their roles reversed, but Barnabas is in the lead at this point. Now let's do a little introduction here to chapter 13. This is a very interesting chapter in a number of ways because of the transition of Saul and how he becomes Paul and becomes very active in the evangelizing the gospel as he does from the teacher in Antioch church to an evangelist. And we'll see the willingness of Barnabas, the lead minister, in terms of his submission to Saul, or who becomes Paul. And he was so to become as a very powerful instrument in God's hands. Over the years in the ministry of the church, sadly, a number of men sought to be in authority and power and became miffed at the church when they were moved from their high positions into something that they viewed as being a lower position within the church, often leaving the church and starting their own organizations. We've seen that happen in the past. Yet Barnabas sees what God is doing through Paul and rejoices that God is using him so powerfully, and he's willing to submit to it. He sees God doing what he's doing through Paul. And we also see the opportunities come to the men who are busy serving God. The unity of these men made them God's team rather than what they could be on their own. Okay, let's start chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. Well, actually, I cover verses 1 and 2 together here. Apparently, although not specifically mentioned in verse 1, someone or some few individuals in Jerusalem among the apostles probably put one of the other men positioned or mentioned in this verse as a pastor or someone directed to care for the Antioch church. The apostles, I think, are beginning to understand that we need, just like Mr. Armstrong came to understand after he established several churches in Oregon, when he would go back to one of the churches that he had established earlier, he realized there was so much confusion and so much headed in the wrong direction. He realized he needed ministers there to be pastors of those churches to take care of them. Well, the same thing, I think, is beginning to happen to the apostles here. They're realizing we need somebody, a representative of the home office, so to speak, or whatever you want to call it, a pastor here to take care of these churches so that they're headed in the right direction. It does not seem that it's Barnabas himself, because he comes later in verse 3, but this group of men were concerned for the growth of the church at Antioch. Most of them were probably good teachers. However, Antioch really required or needed a pastor. It needed someone in the lead. And all these men were not needed to continue to care for just Antioch. So in some way, the Holy Spirit revealed to the group that Barnabas and Saul had a different mission. That of God's will, or what we see today or call evangelism. And as they fasted, seeking God's will, he revealed his will to them. And as I said, to Barnabas and Saul, were to be separated from the work of caring for Antioch to a mission that God had chosen for them in particular. And so the Greek word here for separated means to be set apart. Asphorsate is the verb here. Ordination is the process that we come to see in the New Testament of setting someone apart for a special use to God. And in verse 3, we see it does not say specifically who laid hands on whom. I suspect whoever was the acting pastor here did it. One of the others here, I suspect, but we don't know. They aren't named. But we have no record of Saul or Barnabas having yet been ordained at this point. So it's likely that this is Saul's and Barnabas's ordination into the ministry, although it doesn't come right out and say that specifically. I'm very suspicious that Barnabas was already an elder. He may have been, he may not have been. I really don't know. But he's being ordained, or he's being set apart for a special evangelical work here. But I can't prove that. Luke doesn't give us enough detail to really be certain of exactly what's happening. It could well have been his ordination as an elder as well. We just don't know. I deduce from this that we find in Acts 14:23, which shows the method of setting apart. This was the custom for ordaining and commissioning individuals to serve. After the ordination, they were sent away. Why? Well, sent away to do their mission, to do their evangelical work. Or we might say they were sent or allowed to go on this mission or commission. The Greek word here is apoluo, and it means to loose, to release, to liberate, send away, allow to depart. That's the verb that's used here. So they're being sent, loosed to go from one assignment to another to go do what they are to do. In verse 4 now, remember that Barnabas was in charge of the mission. Saul is assisting him. Where is Barnabas from? He's from Cyprus. Tells earlier in the book of Acts that he's from Cyprus. So Saul is assisting him. And where do they go? Well, they go to Cyprus. This would probably be Barnabas' choice to go there and do some evangelistic work on Cyprus. And so they went to Seleucia, which one of the cities of Cyprus, by ship, and then on, or I'm sorry, not one of the cities of Cyprus, but they went to Seleucia to get a ship to Cyprus. Then in verse 5, when they arrived in Salamis, which is the port city of Cyprus, they reached and they went out to proclaim the word of God, of course, to the synagogues of the Jews. So you start with the synagogues, you go where the Jews are, where the Israelites are, and you preach the gospel. And so that's what they had opportunity to do. And this was primarily where God was calling people out, was from among the Israelites or the Jews at this point. Notice that they had John Mark as their assistant here. It doesn't say too much about him until later on in the mission. Notice that John Mark becomes the source of a disagreement and separation between Barnabas and Saul. And we cannot judge what John Mark did or did not do because it doesn't say. We don't know. The scriptures don't tell us. But we'll see later something about John Mark was the source of a disagreement between the two of them. And there have been various theories about what that disagreement was, from something that was his fault to something he was just faulted for. May not have been his fault. We just don't know. So in verses 6 and 7, while traveling across the island here of Cyprus, they come across this sorcerer or this fake prophet of Jewish background named Bar-Jesus, who was with the proconsul, Sergius Paulus. A proconsul, of course, was typically a former consul of Rome or someone who acted on behalf of the consul, who may have been present in the country. He was very hostile to Barnabas and Saul, or if he was hostile to Barnabas and Saul, he could be a very dangerous adversary, not an ally. And as he wielded the authority of Rome, he didn't want to get in trouble with whoever was the proconsul in a particular city or country, as he wielded the authority of Rome. Or if interested in the gospel, he might become a very great ally to have. But he was desirous to hear the word of God, which is, you know, this is a break for Barnabas and Saul. In verse 8, we find this sorcerer, whose translated name is Elumas, sought to turn the proconsul away from the faith. So we've already got an adversary trying to send this proconsul away from Barnabas and Saul and the true gospel. And the Greek refers to him as Magos. Now, Magos, of course, is translated as Magi in Latin, or a magician. He was a specialist in astrology and the interpretation of dreams, it tells us. Then in verses 9 and 10, now here's what God truly begins to work powerfully in Saul, and to show his power through Saul. By God's Spirit, Saul recognized that something had to be done or the proconsul would be turned away and become hostile to them. And Saul, who begins to be called Paul here, perhaps taking the, you know, the name, this guy's name was Sergius Paulus. Is that where Paul maybe got the idea to be called Paul? Looks him in the eye and calls him what he is, an emissary of the devil. Now, that's pretty powerful and pretty aggressive, but God's Spirit is driving him to do this, and his function here is to pervert the truth of the Lord. That's what he's trying to do. And so Paul takes action on this. And in verse 11, and in this very moment, God apparently inspires Paul to proclaim what his fate will be before everyone who's listening, probably including the proconsul. So if there's any way to influence the proconsul in the right direction, God is about to do it here through Paul. And he is to be blind for a time. And Paul perhaps did not know how long it was God's intent for the man to be blind. So he just says he's going to be blind for a time. And he uses the word kairos in Greek. Kairos is a limited period of time. We don't know what it is, but it has a purpose, that this time period will have some result or a limited purpose in some way. And so he's going to be blind for a season, is somehow, season is another way of translating kairos into English. But he's going to be limited, or this limited period of time in which he's going to be blind, probably for the benefit and the circumstance or for the suitableness of the circumstances here, however long that time period was. I don't know. It could also be a marked season of time, like we would call fall or spring, a season, a period of time that we have kind of general ideas about how long that period of time is. But even the use of this word doesn't necessarily provide us with an exact period of time. So again, Paul may not have known what God intended in terms of the length of time. So this Magi, or this great one, Megas in Greek is a great one. Magia is something that's large or great in Greek. And so this Magi, somebody who thinks they're pretty great, Paul talks to this thing, and he uses the Greek word to call this guy by, or Luke does, in terms of recording it. It comes from a family of words meaning great in Greek. So the Magi wasn't really as great as he thought he was. It's another way to look at the verse, a little bit humorous way to look at it. Who knows? Did God's Spirit direct Paul in doing this, put this into his head? How did God's Spirit lead Paul to do this? Well, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to speculate exactly how did God inform Paul that this is what he was to do. Or was it Paul had been thinking, perhaps, about Moses and Aaron before Pharaoh? Again, another one of these lessons that seems to be very powerful in terms of God rescuing Peter, all that went on during the days of unleavened bread, what happened during the days of unleavened bread to Moses and Aaron and Israel. Was all this going through Paul's mind and moved Paul to do this? I don't know. But thinking of himself and Barnabas as a type of Moses and Aaron, maybe? I don't know. That it was maybe time that they just did some miraculous things. I guess each of us would have to have been moved directly by God to do something before we would be able to answer a question like that. In verse 12, and of course the results God was looking for, apparently, we see in verse 12 that the proconsul believed, and he was astonished at the teaching of the Lord. I'm sure he was astonished with the miracle that Paul performed here too, or that God performed through Paul here at this point. Then in verse 13, this verse shows something else major that's occurring here too. Notice it is now Paul and his party that sail from Paphos. It's no longer Barnabas and Saul. It's Paul and his party. Or Saul and his party. I have to look at the verse again. But it's a transition that has occurred that's noted by Luke here, our author. Paul is now the head of the team. No longer Barnabas. I suspect that after Barnabas saw God work so powerfully through Paul at this point, he decided, maybe I better follow Paul's lead, because God is really working through this guy. And as probably any one of us who would be humble would be willing to do too. Perhaps this part of the journey on to Perga and Antioch and Pisidia was Paul's idea. And I'm sure inspired by God and God's Spirit as well. Maybe it was Paul who longed, maybe this is what he'd longed to do for a long time. And maybe it came to him when Barnabas asked him, where do you think we should go, Paul? Maybe that's how it happened. I don't know. That was part of Barnabas submitting himself to Paul. Maybe he just simply asked him, where do you think we should go now, Paul? I don't know. Interesting to speculate about exactly how some of these things happened. But anyway, we see John Mark now departs from them at this point. He was very young. Could be for any number of reasons. Maybe he was ill. We don't know exactly why he chose to depart. Then in verse 14, we find Antioch of Pisidia. Is in what is now we call the Turkish Lakes region of modern Turkey. There is an Antioch in northern Palestine, and there is also one in Pisidia. And as their custom was, they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath. This is where they would have had their target Jewish audience. It's also where they would need to keep the Sabbath themselves by attending church and hearing the Word of God read. And taught as well, the scriptures read, which is what they did in the synagogues, and they respectfully sat down to hear the service. However, it was a custom in many of the synagogues at the time to end the service by asking any strangers who were present, but those of the faith, to see if they had something to say. Do you have something to offer now that services are over? We're discussing what's happening. Maybe you have some words of advice, some words of faith or whatever to offer to us. What would you like to say? And verse 15, so the ruler of the synagogue, as the custom was, asked Paul and Barnabas if they had any words of exhortation for the members. If so, speak. So verse 16, we may have what is our first insight into Paul's speaking here. I would love to have heard what Paul had to say. A very honorable introduction, identifying them as the men of Israel. He introduces and shows great favor on them as the men of Israel. And he says, those who fear God, listen to what I have to say. A one-line intro, Paul gets right to the heart of the story, their background, and something that we could all agree with, which, of course, was the story of God bringing Israel out of Egypt. What have they just been talking about during the days of unleavened bread that have gone by not too long ago? Israel bringing God out of Egypt. And so that's where he starts the story. And in verse 17... how could anybody disagree with that? We're talking about our history. Oh, you're going to talk about my history. Okay, I'm game. Go ahead and tell us about it. Verse 18, and though their ancestors were, of course, a rebellious house that God put up with for 40 years, he does have to introduce some things like that, he still brought them into the promised land. And in verse 19, he continues the story of them coming out. And this is the first time I've heard that God destroyed seven nations before Israel in order to bring them into the land of Canaan, that God had distributed to them by lot. I didn't know it was seven nations until I read that in the New Testament. It may say it in the Old Testament, but I guess it blew by me if it was there. But in the New Testament, Paul adds this particular facet of their understanding. In verse 20, Paul now jumps ahead a little in the story to the time of the judges, or about probably 450 years. He talks about the time of the judges. Many scholars who do not believe the Bible try to show here that the period of the judges was not 450 years, that it was much longer than that. But it wasn't, because some of the famous judges and their stories and their recorded history that goes with it, some of those judges lived at the same time. Only part of them were over Israel, or only over parts of Israel. You had a southern kingdom, you had an eastern kingdom. Each of them had judges sometimes running at the same time. So 450 years is the biblically recorded period of time. But people who want to argue with the Bible say, no, the record of all these individual judges takes you much longer than 450 years. Well, that's because some of them served at the same time. Easy way to understand it, but of course people who are critical of the scriptures want to use that against the scriptures. You had a northern series of tribes, a southern group, and an eastern group of Israel. I've got some historical records that actually say which tribes were in each one. But I won't take the time to go back and do that. Until the time of Samuel the prophet. And that's probably a good place to stop. I think I've run out of time here. So, if I remember correctly. Any questions, though? I'll stop and we'll pick up maybe verse 21 next time. Good place to stop with Paul's story here. Yes, any question?
I've got just an idea here. You talked about James. God allowed James to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
He did not allow Peter to be killed.
Right.
And why would that be? But if you think about when Peter was named, his name was Simon, and he says, I will name you Peter, which means the rock, and upon this rock, the boulder, Jesus Christ, I will build my church,
mm-hmm.
and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. If you look at that scripture, it kind of shows that...
But it wasn't talking about Peter being the rock, right?
No, but talks about the key, there would be keys. There's
keys involved. Keys of the kingdom, right.
Okay, I just kind of look at that as God had some plans for him.
Exactly. God did have plans for Peter.
So to take him out at this point wouldn't have
right.
fulfilled those plans God had for him.
Right. And we can look back and we can now, after the fact, we can say, well, you know, he probably did it for this reason and this reason and this reason and this reason, but how many reasons would we have known at the time? you wouldn't. But you're right. Today we can look back and see, why God did something for a lot of different reasons. And maybe a lot of different reasons is not even anywhere near as many as God actually had in mind. So. Okay, any other questions? All right. Well, thanks for coming. Enjoy doing the Book of Acts. I referred to him in the video as well as being a very powerful book. It does have so much to teach us and so many things we can learn from it.